That's considered the beginning of this section. And what is talked about now throughout that section, it goes through 16, is who is Jesus? What do you believe about Jesus Christ? And we'll see, you know, we've gone through a variety of things that people think, and most of them are wrong, and Jesus has to correct them. But by the time we get to the close of 16, Jesus asks the famous question to his disciples, but who do you say I am? Okay? So we're going to reference that kind of emphasis this morning because it comes to a head in chapter 16. So 16 verse 1, and the Pharisees and Sadducees came to test him. They asked him to show them a sign from heaven. Now there are several important things about this. When they have come to him before, it has been kind of a hodgepodge. Some of the Pharisees, a few of the scribes, but it didn't seem to be anything organized. And they were simply asking questions. But when we get to chapter 16, things change. When it says Pharisees and Sadducees, this is the first time the Sadducees are mentioned as coming and asking questions. Now, just for review, Pharisees were lay people. Sadducees were the priests. Okay? They were the priests. The reference to them coming to Jesus here is viewed as now this is truly a serious matter that both scribes and Pharisees have a direct interest in. And they're not coming just to question. Their motivation is stated. They came to test him. They are trying to trap him and test him. Because they do not believe that he is who he says he is. And so they are out to discredit him. That's the first time it truly tells their motivation. And it's the first time that they state not only their motivation, but that this is an organized event. Now, we know it's organized because the Sadducees especially were in Jerusalem. They are way up north. We talked about that last week. Jesus is way up north. They have made a special trip to confront Jesus. A special trip to confront him with what he's teaching and what he's doing. All right. And what do they want him to do? show them a sign from heaven. They wanted to see a sign, small or great, right now, from heaven, that will tell them this is from God. He is from God. His teaching is from God. His miracles are through the power of God. Remember, they had accused him of his miracles being what? Through Satan. They want proof. They want a sign right now. So Jesus responds. And he literally makes fun of them. Okay? He literally makes fun of them. Because he answered them, "When it is evening, you say it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it will be stormy today, for the sky is red and threatening. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you cannot interpret the signs of the times." So he's making fun of them. You know how to tell the weather from heaven. You're being confronted with the Messiah. You're being confronted with the Christ. You're being confronted with the teaching, the miracles. And you can't interpret that. You can't interpret it. You can interpret the weather from the heavens, but you can't interpret what's going on right in front of you that's from heaven, because you have no spiritual understanding. Okay? So, that's what Jesus is saying. That's what Jesus is saying. And we see places in the gospel where Jesus does a sign, and they immediately say, "Show us a sign." They don't see them because their spiritual eyes are closed. Evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of Jonah. The last time some of the Pharisees and scribes confronted Jesus, it was in chapter 12. In chapter 12, if you will recall, they came to confront him about his teachings on the Sabbath day. They wanted to make an issue of the Sabbath day. Jesus did not allow that. Remember, they accused the disciples of eating grain in the field, which was not a violation of the Sabbath day. So Jesus didn't even deal with it and turned the whole thing to a discussion of, "Who am I? I am the Lord of the Sabbath." They kept after him, and after two times of confrontation with them about the Sabbath, then they asked for a sign. And he explained to them that the only sign that was going to be given to them was the sign of Jonah. That as Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights, so the Son of Man would be in the ground 3 days and three nights. Now, what he's saying is this. There's not going to be any signs but one. I'm going to rise from the dead. Then you will know that what I teach is true, and that the miracles I have done are through the power of God. The resurrection will be the sign that confirms it all. And there's not going to be anything given to them before it. And we know what happens. Even when he rises from the dead, they still don't believe. Even the sign of Jonah, they still don't believe. And so, no sign. So he left them and departed. So a formal delegation comes from Jerusalem to question him, and he gives them nothing. Okay? Gives them nothing. The next account kind of plays upon this account to a point. He made the Pharisees and the Sadducees look very bad. The disciples are going to look like idiots. And that's putting the best construction on everything. Okay? In the next account, it's called by many commentators comical with what happens. Comical what happens. Look at verse 5. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus said to them, "Watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." And they began discussing it among themselves, saying, "We brought no bread." What? They didn't bring any bread. He's warning them against the scribes and the Pharisees, and they think Jesus is mad because they forgot to bring bread. Okay? They forgot to bring bread. But Jesus, aware of this, said, "O you of little faith, why are you discussing among yourselves the fact that you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive? Do you not remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many baskets you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many baskets you gather? How is it that you fail to understand that I did not speak about bread?" In other words, what he's saying to them is simply this. You're over there discussing, "We forgot the bread," after you have seen Jesus Christ provide 5 loaves to feed 5,000 people and 4,000 people, and you're worried that you forgot to bring bread? I mean, this is just, you can't write this stuff. They are just in la-la land, okay? Just in la-la land. Then, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. They finally got it. Now, What are we talking about when we say the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? We don't think that Jesus is referring back to what the Pharisees said about the Sabbath day. We don't think he's referring to what the Pharisees and Sadducees, how they interpreted the law. The most critical thing is who Jesus is. So the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees here that is most concerning is that he teaches that Jesus isn't Christ. He isn't the Messiah. He isn't the one we're waiting for. Don't put your faith in him. That would be the critical teaching. See, they're up there trying to disprove his ministry. Cast aspersions, cast doubt on it. That would be the critical teaching. Not some technical point on the Sabbath day. Not some technical point on how to interpret this passage in the law. The critical point of this time, and we've seen this in this whole section, chapter 11 through 16, is, who am I? Who do you say I am? So he is most, the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees that is most dangerous is the teaching that Jesus Christ isn't the Christ, isn't the Messiah. Okay? That's the critical part. Which leads to one of the greatest passages in Matthew, which is 16, beginning at 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, where is he? That's about 25 miles north of the Sea of Galilee. So it's pretty far up there, north of the Sea of Galilee. This time, he initiates. He asked his disciples, who do people say that the Son of Man is? Who did they say? All right. Notice that the question is not, and this is going to become important later, this question is not directed just to Peter. It's directed to all the disciples. All the disciples. Some say John the Baptist. All right? Remember, Herod Antipas himself believed that Jesus was John the Baptist come back from the dead. Others say Elijah. There had been talk about Elijah. Malachi says before any of this happens, Elijah must come. The disciples ask about Elijah. Jesus tells them that John the Baptist was Elijah, the spirit of Elijah. And so some say Elijah. Others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Out of all the prophets, why Jeremiah? The speculation is that Jeremiah talks extensively about the destruction of Jerusalem, extensively by the Babylonians. There is great concern on the part of those in Judea about what's going to happen to Jerusalem under the Romans. Plus, there are many prophecies about Christ in Jeremiah. So we believe that Jeremiah may be one of those prophets that's being read because of all it says about what's going to happen to Jerusalem. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" And the "you" there is plural. He's then asking all the disciples, "Who do you say I am?" Every person in the world has to answer that question. Every person. Not just for the disciples. For you and me. Who do you say I am? That's the question. See, there's been all these questions, all these thoughts, all these different theories about who he is. Everybody had their own views of what the Messiah would be like, what he would do, all of that. Are you the one to come, or should we look for another? Now the question, but who do you say I am? Okay. Simon Peter replied. He is replying for the other disciples. "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Peter doesn't get much right, but he did here. He nailed it. He nailed it. But notice what Jesus says about his confession. And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah." Bar-Jonah is Hebrew for son of Jonah. "For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Now, you don't come to know Jesus Christ on your own. On your own. And that's one of the primary articles in the Lutheran faith. That's expressed in the scriptures. I cannot, by my own reason or strength, believe in Jesus Christ, my Lord, or come to him. It is not something a sinful heart can do. You cannot, under your own power, decide that you are going to believe in Jesus Christ. It is a gift. It is a gift from God that is worked in you by God. So Jesus is saying to Peter, you did not come to this conclusion. You are not able to make this confession by any other way except that God has revealed it to you. And we need to keep that in mind. None of us can say Jesus is Lord unless God worked that faith in our hearts. The answer to the question, "Who do you say I am?" is an answer that is given to us by God, because we don't know it on our own. God has to show us that. He does so through his word. He does through baptism. It is a gift of God. That's how Peter comes to know this. Now, the next part, there's been so much debate over the centuries. Jesus is speaking, "And I tell you, you are Peter, And on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. All right. The Roman Catholic Church believes that this passage establishes the Bishop of Rome as the supreme spiritual ruler of the Catholic Church and of all Christendom, the Pope. That has always been their teaching. That has always been their teaching. Luther called that into question. And basically he said, is God going to build his church on a sinful human being? On a sinful human being. And he said, absolutely not. Now, there's been all kinds of studying, all kinds of things here. This is the first time Peter's called Peter here. He's been called Simon. He's been called Simon. Peter is rock. Peter is rock. And on this rock, now, there are several things we have to take into consideration here. First of all, as I told you, all the questions have been asked of all the disciples, and that will continue later. Peter simply answers for the disciples the question, if indeed Jesus is establishing Peter, then why doesn't it say, and I tell you, you are Peter, and on you, the rock, I will build my church? It does not say that. It does not say that. I want to read you, or you can look it up, okay? I want you to look up the passage of Ephesians 2:20. This is one of the passages that is sometimes talked about as helping us to answer this question. Built, and this is talking about the church. Let's go back to 19. So then, you are no longer strangers and aliens, but you are fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, built upon the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Christ himself being the cornerstone. Right? There are many that believe that that's what we're getting at here. Because the 12, went down to 11 and back to 12, were literally the ones that would take the message of Jesus Christ to the world. Their teaching would be the teaching of Christ to the world. And that what's being said here is that Jesus is going to build his church on the word of Christ that these disciples are going to preach and teach the world. Jesus is called the rock all over the Old Testament. But the church is built on the word that these disciples would teach and preach. Okay? So it's built upon the foundation of the apostles, Christ being the chief cornerstone. Many people look at that as the best answer to this question. As the best answer to this question. That's what the church is built on. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it, because it is the word of Christ. It is the word of Christ. All right. Let me stop there and ask for questions. That's a big load there.
Just to go back to the beginning, is the fact that the scribes are not mentioned in this pericope, is that important? Was it like the two main parts of Congress left their lawyers and clerks behind and just went at this?
Yeah, it kind of can be viewed like that. The scribes were not thought of as religious leaders. They were kind of a second rate compared to the actual Pharisees and Sadducees.
Did the scribes and Pharisees interpret the literal story about Jonah as being about the resurrection at that time? In other words, did they understand what Jesus was saying to them about the sign of Jonah?
They had never interpreted Jonah that way. They did not know that until Jesus applied that to his own life. Then, that was the first time they heard it. We'll get there, Jan.
I get to shout.
No, you got to wait.
Okay.
Well, while you're talking about Jonah, I find it interesting that Jesus says the sign of Jonah, and at the same time, Peter, who's the son of Jonah, makes this confession, which is the key, right?
Yeah.
That Jesus is the Christ.
Yeah, I mean, it's good stuff. I don't know if anybody intended that, but we can make that out of it. Yeah, Jan?
I think Dr. Bender said it right. It was my understanding that it was Peter's confession was interpreted to be the rock, his confession of faith, and it was upon that confession that the church...
That has been a major emphasis over the years. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God, which means the church is built on Christ.
Two quick things. Can you really talk about 19 without bringing verse 20 into the thing? Because there it says, and I will...
Yeah, we'll get to
it's
that.
It's plural.
That's
yeah.
Right.
And secondly, you mentioned that the Catholic Church had always believed this, but up until the split between Orthodoxy and the Western Church, did that early unified church accept this, or was that something that Rome brought in around the time of the split?
I'm not sure of that, but it wasn't a reason for the split. The two reasons that the Eastern Orthodox Church left were the date of Easter, and by the way, the Western Church, we lost that one. Okay, and icons. Okay, those were the two reasons the Eastern Church left the Western Church. Didn't have anything to do with the Bishop of Rome. Other than that, I would have to study it to find out if that was an issue. Yeah.
In this, when he speaks of the prophets, he says the apostles and the prophets.
Yes.
Is that a reference to Old and New Testament?
It's probably a reference. You know how the There's lots of references to 24 elders in the book of Revelation. Many believe that's the 12 apostles and the 12 tribes of Israel. The prophetic voice is talked about as a whole. And so it's talking about all the prophecies that came from God about the Christ. All right, let's move on to, as Bud says, 19, because it is important. Because it can't be just Peter. Because it says, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and you there is plural. It's all the disciples, not just Peter. Keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven. All right, so what he's saying here is the proclamation of the forgiveness of sins is primary. When there is the proclamation of the forgiveness of sins, it opens heaven's door. But in the case of people who are unbelieving, unrepentant, it locks the door to heaven. It locks the door. So that's what's being said here. Now, it's actually the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. In other words, it's bound on earth, but it's going to apply, will be bound, carried out in heaven, etc. Now, we apply this to what we call the office of the keys and confession in Luther's small catechism. But let's not get too narrow-minded here. It's not just for pastors. This is bigger. This is the total proclamation of the word in all the world. It does apply to pastors when they're dealing with their people. And when someone confesses their sins, they assure them of their forgiveness. It does apply there. But we're talking about literally Jesus giving this proclamation of forgiveness to the world, to the disciples who will carry it to others and others and others to the world. Okay? It does apply to pastors when they're dealing with their people, but it's also much bigger than that. Much bigger than that. The last verse. Then he strictly charged the disciples. Notice, it's plural again. See, all these pronouns are plural. Okay? Which means he's talking to all of them. He strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Why? Because there were so many opinions on what the Christ was, would be, would do among the people of Judea and Galilee, that it was not the time to be saying, here's Jesus. Because they all would have had their own expectations of him after that. Wrong expectations. The true Christ was not what any of them thought. None of them could describe it. They were all wrong. By pointing to him as the Christ, it would just bring more confusion. There is no way to understand that he is the Christ until his suffering, death, and resurrection. That's what defined him as the Christ. All other opinions about him are up for grabs and are probably not correct. The Christ is defined by the purpose he came for, his suffering, death, and resurrection. Now, we see that immediately. All right? We see that immediately. We're going to touch on it today, and we'll do more next week. But we want to see this immediately. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." The great Peter, who said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God," has just denied the statement. You're not the Christ if you're going to act like this. You're not the Christ if you're going up to Jerusalem and suffer and die. No, that's not what the Christ does. See? See how quick it shifts? See how quick it shifts? Because Peter's confessed he was the Christ, that's true. But Peter had his own expectations of what the Christ should do. And Jesus wasn't describing the expectations that Peter had correctly. Peter's saying, I know what the Christ should be, and suffering and dying in Jerusalem is not it. So you see, that's why Jesus doesn't want the disciples going around saying he's the Christ. Because there's too many expectations, too many false teachings. And all it's going to do is cause confusion and muddy the water. Now, we'll do some more with this account when we pick up next week. The middle section of Matthew is considered to have ended at chapter 16, verse 20. The new section begins, "From this time Jesus began to show his disciples." This is his first prediction of what he has to do as the Messiah, his first prediction. First time he's told them what he has to do. And they don't like it. All right, we got time for just a few more questions and then we'll call it a day. It's a big section. Yeah, Bob.
Is this, you know, we Christians in this day and age have a lot of hindsight that
Right. They didn't have.
Is this kind of Jesus softening them up or even the Spirit trying to get rid of the old Judaic teachings and everything else, and they really never had it all gelled until Pentecost?
That's really true. They had bits and pieces given to them. Some of it they probably understood, some of it they didn't. But they didn't put the whole thing together until the Holy Spirit came at Pentecost. They just didn't have it. Just didn't have it. It's not that Jesus didn't teach it. They just didn't have it. Other things? Yeah, Nancy. Oh.
How far into the ministry is this? Is this like the first 6 weeks?
This is probably 2 years in. Of the 3 years, we're getting there. We're getting there. Yeah. Yeah, bud.
I'm not certain, not having one of those concordance things with me, but I think this is the first time that in any dialogue the word Christ is even mentioned. It's mentioned back when the by the author, by Matthew himself, in reference to something, but I don't think the word Christ is used. This must be the first time.
Yeah, that's right. I'm almost positive that's right. The other titles for the Messiah, the big one is Son of David. That had been used. And it's interesting to note, the religious leaders didn't call him that. Two blind guys along the road called him the Son of David. And where did they get it? Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. All right? Well, God writes good stuff, doesn't he? Grace of our Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all. Amen.